If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board, while Will Erskine booking the guests, and the legendary CHML newsroom Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. So, you know me. I'm all about the fun. I'm kidding. And let me explain something, though, because I think a lot of people are confused as to what people like me do for a living. And what we do for a living is we opinionate. We, like a columnist in a newspaper, we offer opinion. We take the news of the day, we consume it, we regurgitate it, and we give you our take on it. That's what opinionators do. That's what talk show hosts do. Very, very, very different from what the great people in the CHML newsroom do, who are some of the finest reporters and news anchors in the country, and they deliver you unbiased the facts the way they're supposed to do it. We listen to those same newscasts, and then we give you opinion. That's what all of the different talk show hosts do, whether it's Radley, myself, Rick, Roy Green, whoever. So anyway, I want to preface what I'm going to say about that, because I got a letter because this lady's upset because I keep referring to the homeless encampments as Trudeau tents. And I can't take credit for this line because it wasn't mine. I heard it somewhere, but I can't remember where. And it was a few weeks ago, and I thought, wow, that's pretty intense. And then I thought, you know, as we try to figure out what's going on here, you know, and you get through the clutter of what the messaging is from any political party or even pundits like me, sooner or later, the message becomes crystal clear, and it becomes very, very simple. And my whole issue with the Trudeau tents is, and this lady that, Darlene, who sent me a note, blaming it on Doug Ford, and I'm getting my provincial and municipal politics mixed up and all this other stuff. This is happening in every province. It's happening from east to west. It's happening in British Columbia today, which is under NDP rule, where they're moving a tent encampment as we speak. Because of the rat infestations and the problems that are going on there. Go to the opposite side of the coast, where we've got a liberal Atlantic premier who is against the carbon tax, but has tents as well. And they're not just in Hamilton or Ontario cities. They're across the land. They're in big cities. They're in small. And again, to cut through the clutter, it's very, 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 very simple. Coming out of a global pandemic, when everything is stressed to the max, you learn from that, you expand your systems, you make adjustments. You don't just bring in a whole pile of people. And again, I don't want to make this an immigration issue about immigrants coming in or out, because then the whole racial thing starts. We're all immigrants. My mom was an immigrant. I'm first generation Canadian. Know the whole story. We've all got them. The war, the running to bomb shelters, all that stuff. We're all there. That's what Canada is. So let's not make it that. It's a case of you bring in over a million people. When 2 years ago, the immigration department is saying, don't do it, you're going to overcrowd the systems. And that's everything. And the advocates for the homeless will be quick to say it trickles down. Well, here's a great example. If people in the middle class can't afford a home, if they don't have a place to stay, chances are those in the segment of the population that are trying to make the middle class are experiencing, but even greater. So again, too many people chasing too many services, too few services rather, too many people chasing too few services, an issue we had prior to the pandemic, a situation we're working on post-pandemic, and then all of a sudden, boom, this. And don't take my word for it, because the Prime Minister has reversed two of his own targets by capping his own targets in the last 2 weeks when he said, oh, yeah, we're going to put a pause on the temporary residents. Oh, yeah, we're going to put a pause on international students. And then everybody's like pointing at every other service that can't keep up or the rippling effect has touched. And it all stems from one thing. Canada loves immigration. But you have to have the services available to those in your country as well as those that you are inviting in to join this great land. And I don't know how many more experts I have to have in this show, whether it's immigration, healthcare, whether it's housing, and said, this is another self-inflicted wound. No plan. No plan. No plan. And now we have to fix it. I don't know how to fix it, but I think we should learn something so we don't get here again by having a plan to deal with it in the first place. We talked way back when about the pic and the Photoshop and whatever was done. And I was like, oh yeah, whatever. And then it kind of went to an affair, or there was rumors that an affair was going on. This, of course, with Kate Middleton, who had been in the hospital, getting abdominal surgery. And, you know, and at that point I'm out. So then I'm watching TV, last week, and you remember TV? And there's Stephen Colbert, and I watch all these shows, and I'm sort of paying attention. I'm not. I think I'm falling asleep. And he's got a teacup, a saucer and a teacup, obviously English, and he's doing a about the Royals. And it's like, I don't even know what he said, but I just thought, oh man. And then last night I'm watching, and very sheepishly, he comes out and he says this.
Everybody has been talking about the mystery of Kate Middleton's disappearance from public life. And 2 weeks ago, we did some jokes about that mystery and all the attendant, you know, frou-fra in the reporting about that. And when I made those jokes, that upset some people. And even before her diagnosis was revealed. And I can understand that. I mean, a lot of my jokes have upset people in the past. And I'm sure some of my jokes will upset people in the future. But there's a standard that I try to hold myself to, and that is I do not make light of somebody else's tragedy. I and everyone here at The Late Show would like to extend our well wishes and heartfelt hope that her recovery is swift and thorough.
You want that thorough recovery. We edited that together, by the way, to shorten it. And I don't think everybody jumped on this. And, you know, I'm not a royal watcher, per se. I'm just thinking, like, who cares? And the other thing I'm thinking, is this an apology? Because I didn't hear that. It's just that that's his gig. I don't know. Maybe I do the same thing. That's what I do when I offer opinion and I tick people off. But I don't know. I don't want to get, even Donald Trump, I don't want to hear about his escapade with the porn star. Like, really? No, thanks. Let's bring in Alyssa Freeman, PR and pop culture expert with us now. Alyssa, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yes, I am, Scott. Thank you for having me on.
Is that an apology or a justification?
Yeah, no, it's not a justification. And I think that it was the right thing to do. You know, a lot of people, you know, when you're in late night TV, your monologue is really all about jumping on the current event and making something out of it. And in this case, it's something that will always be funny. You know, where is Kate? What is she doing? Da, da, da. So I think that when you realize that all your joking and all your jocularity was really not in line with what the eventual outcome was, I think that it really is incumbent upon some of these late night hosts to say when they're wrong. And to say, like, it's one thing, you know, to poke fun, and then there's one thing when there is a real problem. And I think that, you know, for all the people who sort of made hay out of a cancer diagnosis, although they didn't know it at the time, but it was all really based on speculation. So they made hay out of a lot of speculation. And a lot of people sort of ate crow at that point. You know, all the people on Instagram, all the nasty commenters, all the other voyeurs, all the reporters, you know, that report on this, especially in the British press, were all sort of taken aback and they were a bit mollified. And I think that it was really a bold move for Colbert to come out and say, you know what? It was wrong. And I apologize for doing that. Not to say that, you know, this is going to be a blanket apology every time he makes fun of somebody, Scott. So I don't think I, you know, we're not going to take that there. But I think in this case that he was justified in his words.
I watched Jimmy Kimmel. I watched him talk about the same sort of thing. No apology needed. And I think the difference is one's takes it in context. The other one makes it quite personal and in some situations mean.
Well, I think
is it the message or the delivery here, Alyssa?
It's the delivery. And I think that some hosts really do want to veer from the persona that they've created on TV. You know, both of these men have been hosts of their respective shows for a number of years. And, you know, both are used to being in the limelight. And both are also used to pushing, you know, the envelope where needed and where they feel needed and where possible. So for one to make an obvious apology and one to sort of do it as the course of business really sort of fits in with their TV personas. Although, you know, we have seen Kimmel be, you know, get emotional over things.
Yeah, like I don't mean this as a slight to Kimmel in any way. Like, but I really did, like when I watched Stephen Colbert, I thought, this is tasteless. And then I didn't say that when I'm watching the same subject covered by Jimmy Kimmel. And again, I think it's because one's got a mean streak. The other one's kind of jovial and just a great comedian.
Well, the other one is also just, you know, listen, and then here's the other side of the coin to what I just said. We didn't have all the facts. Yeah. The royal family themselves bungled a number of things along the way, especially which fueled a lot of the speculation, which was all the doctored photos. And to have to keep backpedaling. You know, there's a quote from, I think it was O. Henry's, that, oh, what a tangle web we weave when we first practice to deceive. You know, when you think that you're going to do something that will just be a stopgap, but there's a number of untruths that back it up, well, then, quite frankly, it's not much of a stopgap. And the hole that you dig keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So while Colbert says, well, I'm going to ignore all that, and I'm just going to concentrate on Kate, and I was wrong for the way I attacked that subject. Whereas Kimmel says, listen, I worked with, you know, what we had, and this is the outcome, and now let's move along. So two very points of view, very different points of view, two very different hosts, and two very different narratives.
So with that being said, do we talk about Prince Harry's name appearing in court documents with Sean Diddy Combs?
Well, isn't that juicy? No one will ask me that.
But
he said,
but again,
do you want to talk about this? And I'm like, well, of course I do.
Well, so, but what do we know? We don't know anything, do we?
We don't know anything. I think that he was probably at a number of parties that were held at P. Diddy's house. And I'm pretty sure William was there, too. I think that William has a better relationship with Rupert Murdoch, which owns a number of these publications, to make sure that he was cut out of all those photos and that just exposed Harry. So I don't think there's any real connection with the alleged, you know, sex trafficking, et cetera, that they're looking into Sean Combs for. But it certainly, I mean, you know, if you want optics to kind of play into something and maybe create a narrative where there isn't really one, I think that's what this is all about.
Yeesh, what a tangled web we weave. Alyssa Freeman, Alyssa PR, pop culture expert. Alyssa, as always, thank you for the time. Be well.
And you too, Scott.
Four gunmen charged in the murder of at least 139 concert goers at Moscow's at a Moscow City Hall theater, where citizens, where you know, it's terrorism, plain and simply. Let's leave it at that. It's coming to light more about this story, and what is Russia's relationship with terrorist organizations. Matthew Light with his associate professor of criminology, sociological studies, University of Toronto, and here now. Matthew, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Yes, great to be with you.
We've heard after this attack that there was a certain amount of intelligence floating around. Even U.S., I understand, had advised some of its citizens to be aware of the situation in Russia. What do we know about this actual attack?
Well, it has been claimed by an affiliate or a daughter organization of ISIS, the Islamic State. The motivation for it was not immediately made clear in their statement, but I think the most likely explanation is that it has to do with Russia's intervention in the Syrian civil war, in which Russia has supported the Syrian regime of Bashar Assad, who is a very repressive ruler who has carried out appalling massacres, and in some cases using poison gas, against a variety of opponents, one of which is ISIS. So although you might not associate Russia with Middle East conflict, it is in fact quite heavily embedded in that one.
How does that affect world events, considering where we are with so many other things going on?
Yeah, that's a good question. So this seems to be quite embarrassing for the Putin regime for a number of reasons. I suppose the obvious one is that although perhaps in a certain sense it's true, right, that every successful terrorist attack, particularly really spectacular ones, is in some sense a security failure. And as you noted, there were some warnings from others, including the U.S., that something like this might be in the works. Nonetheless, there is a sense in which this is kind of particularly embarrassing for the Putin regime, which has kind of built its legitimacy on restoring Russia's strength and actually was founded or came into being in part as a reaction to the Chechen insurgency of the 1990s and early 2000s. Putin himself actually came to power in the wake of a series of bombings carried out by allegedly by Chechen terrorists, although many people think that he may have orchestrated them. So I suppose one implication of this is that he looks rather ineffectual. And that may be why he has chosen to try to deflect the discussion immediately from the failure to anticipate an ISIS attack or to address it properly, or even the nature of Russia's involvement in Syria, to the preferred enemy, which of course is Ukraine. So right. In the days since the attack, he and his advisors have been spinning this line that Ukraine was somehow involved in it.
Even taking that stance, it would say then Ukraine has been quite successful. I mean, does any one of those scenarios play well for him?
Well, I think in some sense, none of them do, right? I mean, what happened. It's a horrible atrocity. A lot of innocent people were killed, and Putin failed to stop it. So why might he prefer to pin the blame on Ukraine? Well, I think Ukraine, first of all, he's already fighting a war with Ukraine. So
yeah.
One can certainly impute to him that sort of desire, right, to turn this embarrassment into at least a way of whipping up popular sentiment against Ukraine and possibly justifying another round of mobilization of Russian men to be sent to Ukraine as combat soldiers. I suppose it's also possible that there could be a separate motivation, which is simply that Putin has portrayed the Syria mission or his involvement in Syria as a big success for Russia. And if it's actually giving rise to barbaric terrorist attacks within Russia's capital, it starts to look a bit less successful. So I think possibly avoiding questions about why Russia might have been targeted in this way might also be in his interest.
How does he balance world order with this and what he's obviously trying to sell domestically? At the end of the day, as you mentioned, he's failed to protect them from terrorism. So and they're having obviously a difficult time containing or winning over Ukraine. Can they now focus on this sort of battle as well?
Well, years ago, in the wake of 9/11 in 2001, Russia and the U.S. did sort of find common cause fighting Islamist terrorism, or at least it appeared that way for a few years. I think it's harder to imagine that something like that emerging now. I mean, for one thing, the U.S. has moved on to some degree from that focus. And in fact, Russia is now seen as one of the main opponents of the U.S. along with China. So it's a little harder to build bridges with something like this, even though, of course, it's also true that plenty of Western countries have been targeted by ISIS over the years for similar reasons, right? It's not that Russia is unique in this respect. I do think there is a kind of particularly embarrassing quality in this one, though, in this incident, though, in that Russia has, in recent years, sort of suggested that Western countries that get hit by terrorism, it's because they're imperialists. There's no way around it. This is a group of people from the Middle East using violence to resist or to oppose Russia's involvement there. I don't think Russia particularly wants to be seen to be in the company of the US, UK, and other Western countries in the Middle East. And now they're sort of being shown in that light, whether they like it or not.
As you mentioned earlier, alluded to, we always look at Russia as the attacker, not the one that is being attacked. How does this destabilize Russia? Does it?
Well, I don't think it will bring about the fall of the regime. As I mentioned, I do think it sort of further dents Putin's image as a strong defender of Russian the Russian people against external enemies. When life gives you lemons, you make lemonade, right? And I think it's pretty clear that Putin's strategy is going to be to try to turn this into a tool of mobilization against Ukraine. That's why he's really declined to talk about ISIS and has focused much more on the alleged Ukrainian involvement, which I think is quite silly. So it doesn't seem like a positive. Whether it will be a huge negative remains to be seen. My initial assessment is that it's likely to be a modest negative. It's clearly not going to do anything for his image, but I don't see why it would seriously rock the foundation of his government.
What about further attacks? Because obviously, in the eyes of the terrorists, this was successful.
Yeah, and they've already said that they might do this again. In particular, after pictures came out showing that the suspects that Russia has accused of this crime appear to have been tortured, in some cases quite savagely. One of them had his ear ripped off, and possibly the same person, another one had been tortured with electricity. And ISIS has now said that they might retaliate with a further round of attacks. The more attacks there are, presumably the worse it looks for Putin. Whether that could actually in the long run be seriously destabilizing, I don't know. But the immediate consequence is certainly that Putin will and has already begun to sort of ramp up domestic repression. In particular, there is evidence that the government is already beginning kind of a wave of targeted arrests and other forms of retaliation against members of the Central Asian guest worker population in Russia. As your listeners probably know, the Central Asian republics were formerly part of the Soviet Union, and many of their citizens now live and work in Russia, performing mostly manual labor. They're by and large quite secular. A few clearly have been recruited into ISIS, and now we're looking at the possibility of some kind of witch hunt against them, or sort of more egregiously racist campaigns against this community.
The fallout of the Moscow Concert Hall terrorist attack. Matthew Light with us, Associate Professor of Criminology, Sociological Studies, University of Toronto. Matthew, thank you for the update. Much appreciated. Be well.
My pleasure. Take care.
There's another world leader banging on Canada's door looking for Canadian liquefied natural gas to help them get off coal and, of course, off the teat of Russia. And as a matter of fact, the Greek prime minister in town and saying, can you get this stuff to the Mediterranean? We would love that. Dan McTagg with us, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP and here now. Dan, thanks for the time. Are you surprised that there's another leader banging on the door?
Nope, because those are leaders that actually give a damn about their country, unlike the leader we currently have, who doesn't seem to understand that you got significant senior European G7 leaders that are now saying, look, could you give us some LNG? Can you give us some natural gas? You're a country that is blessed with it. We don't want your hydrogen. We don't want your fantasies where you're going to spend billions of dollars of consumer money to produce an energy that takes twice the amount of money in order and twice the amount of energy to produce one unit of that thing. And so I think what you're seeing is very clearly an example of a prime minister who is going to dig in his heels. And unfortunately for Canadians, you're going to have to endure this nonsense for the next 20 months. And you're going to suffer because the economy continues to incur debt because it's not creating any type of incentive to get investments in this country.
This all while, Dan, the Bank of Canada announcing today that productivity is at emergency levels. It's an emergency concern and it's fueling inflation. So here again, an opportunity to sell natural resources at a time when Canada's is failing in its productivity. It's falling.
It is falling. The country is falling very deeply into the abyss. And of course, we know we're on a trajectory in the next 30 years to be the worst performer in productivity of GDP per capita performance of any OECD nation. We're the top, where they're going to be at the bottom of the 60. That should be frightening for any NDP Liberal voter that's out there that doesn't recognize you can't continue to have government command and control everything. I know that works in Marxist, you know, communist type of regimes and command systems, but it isn't working well for Canadians. And, you know, I can only say that I would hope that these folks that have committed this country to an absolute decline, I mean, an astonishing decline in our standard of living and our reputation and our economic outlook, which is growing dimmer by the day, would finally realize maybe you're trying to keep your job there to keep your pension to get it maybe in 20 months. But for God's sakes, you're destroying the country in the process. That is something that history is going to judge them on. And they're going to judge the NDP and the Liberal current members of Parliament very harshly on that.
Will we see, as more and more leaders ask for this, will we see that change the discussion? Because really, we all know the Prime Minister doesn't see a business case for this, yet we see ArcelorMittal DeFasco here in Hamilton going to change from coal to electricity. But of course, there's a huge transition period there with natural gas, Alberta energy off of electricity, off of coal. Do you think the worldview, because I think the extreme environment movement has failed here because they failed in the last 20 years to redirect the world off of coal. Instead, it's just shut it all off, can't do anything, shut it all off. And now we're realizing that this is a massive viable option, and it also has a great impact in what they've been wasting their time on in the last 20 years, and that is getting the world off of coal.
Yeah, well, Ontario did that a long time ago. I mean, we brought in nuclear energy quite some time ago. We've replaced oil furnaces with natural gas furnaces. We've done much to try to provide and to modernize our system without crippling the economy. And yet we have dunderheads out there who may represent a small fringe group of 10 to 15% who think they call the shots. Those days are ending, and you can see it, because in Europe it's ending. The farmer protests, the changes to these renewables legislation, this attempt at trying to stop food production so that people wind up having to eat bugs. And I'm not being facetious about this. This is exactly the kind of agenda that's being promoted by the United Nations and the WEF. This is a country. It's a democratic country. It's sovereign. We should have that kind of adult discussion among ourselves, not allow a bunch of fanatics and grifters whose only reputation is to continue to push this idea that an inert gas like CO2, which is so small that it can't even possibly hurt the atmosphere, is not driving weather. And at the end of the day, what it is doing is driving people into the ground. I just wish there were days like today where I was still back in politics, because I tell you, I'd be pushing back on the 250 woke types that represent your country and are driving it into places I would never imagined in this kind of circumstance.
You know, Dan, if you want to make that jump, I'm sure you'll have a few friends that'll help you there. But I understand. So will the Greek Prime Minister go home empty-handed like all the rest?
Well, the great Prime Minister in this case, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis, is probably saying, you know, what gives with Canada, shaking his head, as did the Japanese Prime Minister, as did the German Chancellor. And no, they weren't looking for hydrogen. They can make that on their own. They need natural gas. The world wants more of it. And if we don't give it to them, they're going to get it from some pretty shady characters. The question is, can Canadians afford to look $200 billion a gift horse in the mouth, or is this something that they think they can simply borrow money at infinitum in order to keep their standard of living? I think the answer is simple. You need to sell something the world wants. Right now, Canada doesn't have anything anyone wants, and if we have it, we got a prime minister who won't give it to them.
Dan McTagg, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP, the Greek prime minister in town, or in the country, rather, looking for Canadian liquid natural gas. Dan, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Always a pleasure. Take care, Scott.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
Well, I'm not sure we expected this, or did we? For the first time in almost 30 years, part of Donald Trump's business empire has gone public and started trading quite strong. Trump Media and Technology Group, owner of the struggling social media platform Truth Social, made its way to the opening bell today, surged about 56% and then leveled off around $70. To talk more about all of this and what it all means, Moshe Lander with his senior economics lecturer with Concordia University and here now. Moshe, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Hello.
So where did this come from? Was this planned, or is this just another fundraiser when he needs the cash? What's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that you get to list just on a whim. So this is probably something that was in the works for a while. But given that he has some very large settlements against him, and he's having a hard time coming up with cash, He does seem to be Teflon when it comes to these sorts of things. And it just looks like it's fantastic timing that when he can't raise $500 million to pay off debt, next thing you know, he's got about $500 million coming through on this public listing.
One thing Donald Trump likes, that's control. He's giving up here some. What does this mean to him or to his empire?
Yeah, I mean, he's not giving up complete control. He's still going to have some form of shareholdings within the company. And of course, his personality is, let's say, a little outsized. So I'm sure that even if he's not in complete control, you can bet that he's going to be steering behind the scenes, whatever it is that he wants. And you know that if he doesn't get what he wants, then he'll take to X, to Truth Social, to whatever it is that he can get his fingers on and let people know that he's not happy. He apparently can always just spin off a new platform to use as a vehicle for his views on things.
So who buys this? Is this the same people that are signing up to his website and are buying his, you know, his souvenirs?
Yeah, probably. You know, I would probably buy as well, and I can't exactly say that I'm a fan of his or his views. But like you said, it jumped hugely on the first day. And so if you're an investor that's purely just chasing return, in a lot of these IPOs, usually there's a bit of a first day, second day bump before things kind of come crashing down. So it could even be just institutional investors that are agnostic about him or his views of the world and are merely just looking to cash in on driving this thing up, cash out, and then let it flounder from that point forward. The residual shareholders are probably going to be people who actually believe in his platform and obviously in him.
What about the future of this site? Does it generate revenue?
I don't know that a lot of them generate revenue. You know, that's the big thing with tech things, right? Is that they're always promising profit. Next year will be profitable. I've got to assume that this is not a moneymaker. It cannot be doing better than X or Twitter or Instagram or any of these other platforms that have been around a little bit longer and have a little bit less of a strong political affiliation. So, you know, because it truly is an echo chamber on that platform, more so than on other social media, I don't envision how this thing can be profitable. If it's generating revenue, is it enough to cover the costs and how much of that is being used to feed Trump and his expenses? I guess when we go public, we'll get a little bit more insight into that information. But part of the reason, of course, that he finds himself in trouble these days is because his disclosure is a little bit lacking in some cases. So who's to even say if we're going to get necessarily a clear picture when they do have to file?
How do you value something that isn't generating revenue? Is it just demand?
Yeah, when you're not generating revenue, or more specifically, if you're not generating profits, you have to use different techniques. The normal way is that you would take the present value, today's dollars, of all of the future profits that you expect this thing is going to make. And then if you divide that by the number of shares, in theory, that should be what the share is worth. But if you're not making profits now and you don't envision making profits in the future, it can still have value by trying to estimate, say, what this company would be worth if you were to take the value of all of its assets, liquidate them, pay off all of the debts, and whatever amount of money is left over, in theory, is what this firm is worth, divided by the number of shares. That could be a back of the envelope calculation. I assume that a lot of his asset base is based on intangible assets like goodwill. The fact that it's associated with him, his brand, his name is probably deriving some value that's driving this. If he recedes from that, then it's just one more social media platform that doesn't have the scale that the others do. I don't imagine that it would have nearly the valuation that it has at the end of closing today.
How can this help in his legal issues and his campaign? Like, can you pull money directly from this that he's shares he's selling?
Yeah, you know, there might be a little bit of a withholding period. In theory, he was supposed to pay his bills yesterday, so. On whatever level there's an exemption that's being given, or whatever level he's going to have to pay interest on the amount that's unpaid. Yeah, if he's selling out his shares, then it's not fundamentally different than you and I selling shares in Apple. However long that takes for the money to show up in our bank account is as fast as we can use it. If he generates enough cash, you know, it's going to have to probably go through the necessary clearance to make sure it finds its way into the right account. And then, of course, it's going to be, what does the Attorney General in New York do as far as trying to seize that asset? that's going to determine how fast he can pay his bills.
All this while many are questioning Donald Trump's worth. I mean, that's what a lot of these cases are based on, faulty evaluation, faulty reporting and such. I mean, obviously, credibility is not playing in here at all.
No, and that's exactly it. You're trading on name, brand, and the type of people that would find that name and brand to be worthwhile. Like I said, a short-term institutional investor that's just in it for a quick profit isn't going to be around long enough to find out if everything is kosher here. So they don't care, but people over the longer term might find that, yeah, they were sold a false bill of goods. And if they decide to sue him saying that you weren't properly representing yourself when you went public and you were lying to the stock exchange, this is the type of thing that can, again, end in recriminations, lawsuits, and dragging in a whole bunch of other people that want to get their money back as well.
The legend of Donald Trump never ends. Moshe Lander with a senior economics lecturer with Concordia University, Truth Social, now hitting public trading. Moshe, thank you for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Anytime.
Don't go away. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
All right. The Ontario government tabled its 2024 budget today. What does it all mean? Breaking through it all and decoding it. Sabrina Nanji with us, founder of the Queen's Park Observer. And here now, Sabrina, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Yeah, it's been a busy day at Queen's Park.
Yeah. How does that work? Describe that for the average listener, what it's like. You're down there. You're at Queen's Park. You're a Queen's Park reporter. What is it like for on budget day? They hand you this thing. They say, go into a room. What's the process?
Yeah, I mean, I guess post-pandemic lockups are a little more different than we're used to, and every government has their own way of doing it. One thing I loved when the Liberals were in power was that they gave us cookies as part of their media lockups.
Free food.
Exactly. Every journalist's favorite. Not that, you know, meant we wrote only good news stories about them. But this time around, you know, it's kind of the same deal. You get these budget documents, they're top secret until the minister starts speaking in the House later on in the afternoon. It's really, you know, they've had it in the past where even they've had like OPP officers hanging around and making sure you don't leave. It's a little bit more loose now. We're allowed to have our phones. We're allowed to have internet. We just can't give away any details, you know, before the minister makes his big speech. And there's pizza on order.
There you go. Good to know. All right. What stands out for you this time around?
Well, I think a lot of this was, I guess, the good news nuggets. The government kind of scooped itself. I mean, the premier was up for days leading up to today, you know, touting the extension of the gas tax cut. They announced nearly $2 billion for municipalities and housing enabling infrastructure. I think probably one of the biggest things today was a not so good news headline, and that's the deficit is a whopping nearly $10 billion this year. And that is a far cry from the small surplus they were projecting last year. And there's a lot of factors at play there, right? Like we had an economic boom, you know, relatively speaking, after the pandemic. There was an influx of tax revenues, and you know, governments of all stripes were sitting pretty, and you know, the coffers were being filled. That has slowed majorly, and there's other factors at play here, right? Like inflation, a lot of global uncertainty. But one thing that we have seen the fine print on is the cost of Bill 124, that wage capping legislation that the courts upheld as unconstitutional. Unions had challenged it. They won. And now the Ford government is having to pay up, and to the tune of $6 billion, which we saw laid out today. So that includes back pay for teachers, nurses, and other public sector workers. And I think opposition critics have seized on that, but they also say this is pretty much a nothing burger, that this was a missed opportunity for the Ford government to really address affordability. And while there is more for healthcare, a lot of people are saying it's really not enough to fix the system in a way that's, you know, that's adequate. And there's also, you know, not so much on the education front, specifically post-secondary institutions, which are now dealing with a federal international student cap, and they're looking to make up that loss in tuition. So they are getting, you know, just over $1 billion over 3 years. They say that's, you know, nowhere near enough of what they'll need.
Many questioning the spending if you are on the right side of the political spectrum, and some are looking at this and saying this doesn't seem very conservative. It seems as if politics, at least in the province, seems to be moving back to the center, maybe with the help from Bonnie Crombie.
Yeah, and I think that that's, I mean, everything is political, right? So while this is like a policy fiscal document, it's a very political document as well, right? And interestingly, as much as the premier loved to rail against the gravy train, he's actually the biggest spending premier that Ontario has ever had. We're at $214.5 billion with spending and nearly $10 billion deficit. I mean, if you're a, you know, dyed in the wool blue Tory, you're probably not happy here. But I do think that there's a lot, like I said, there's a lot of factors at play here that are out of the province's control. At the same time, we are at least seeing the path back to balance right now. Just interestingly enough, the government is projecting there will be a small surplus in the pre-election budget that comes in 2026, just before Ontarians head to the polls. So you're right. It will be a battle, I think, a tough battle, especially with someone like Bonnie Crombie there, who has said she wants to be, you know, bring the party more towards the center. We have seen Doug Ford sort of emphasize the progressive part of progressive conservative. But folks in the NDP and even in the Liberals say that even though this is a very big spendy budget, it's not keeping up with inflation. And there are a lot of there's a lot that the Ford government could have done here that they didn't do.
Many times you hear the opposition say the conservatives are just going to cut. This doesn't really suggest that if it's one of the biggest spending budgets we've had, if not the biggest.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a big document. I'm still parsing it. So I will keep you posted on what I see in the cuts. But some of the framing here, especially from opposition critics, labor unions and advocates, they say that if your spending is not keeping up with the rate of inflation, which, as we know, is sky high right now, it essentially amounts to a cut, right? So I think it depends on your vantage point. Certainly, I think not everyone everyone of every political stripe is probably not happy with this deficit. But I do think that some parties would probably be okay with running a deficit as long as our public services are getting the money they need. I mean, you just need to have any interaction with the healthcare system to know that, you know, something really needs to be done on that front. And we have seen billions more, especially on primary care and home and community care, which I guess the idea is to ease up the burden on our long-term care system.
You know, how do you balance all this, Sabrina? Because, again, we've been having this discussion earlier on in the show that, we know that we need immigration in this country. We need more people to come in here. Even our employment rates would suggest that. However, when you overload a system and there's just too many people chasing too few services, we end up where we were or where we are. It seemed post-pandemic we were on our way, and then there was just too many chasing too few services. Does that message resonate even with the province to go towards the federal government?
I, of course. And I think that, you know, Doug Ford has played that politically as well, too. I mean, he says the same thing. You know, we really need newcomers. We need immigrants. Our labor market needs it. But then he'll quickly pivot and say, well, where are all these people going to go? And I'm not sure, you know, which newcomers are essentially buying like a single family home in the suburbs as soon as they get to Canada. But, you know,
no, but they're exhausting every other services and that just trickles down. Right.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that there is something to be said, I guess, because that's how Ford essentially had framed some of that, the carving up of the Greenbelt, which has now been reversed. But I think one thing that people probably are going to be a bit worried about in terms of immigration, but even just, you know, for everybody, is that the housing starts that we've seen here, it sort of pours cold water on the Ford government's ambitious goal of building 1.5 million new homes by 2031. Like, we've seen the numbers behind this, and we know that we need an average of 150,000 annual housing starts a year to hit that target. And we've seen the numbers now. And while the numbers are going up slightly from roughly 80,000 in 2022 to just over 100,000 in 2023, which we found out today, it's still a far cry. And the Ford government is also counting, you know, long-term care beds, laneway homes, additional units in terms of that, in terms of those homes. So I think that, you know, while there is more money for cities and towns to get that housing enabling infrastructure, a lot of people are going to be looking to the Ford government to be bold on other policies. I'm thinking of fourplexes in particular, which is the latest fight we've seen between Bonnie Crombie and Doug Ford.
It's going to take us a while to get out of this one. Sabrina Nanji with us, founder of the Queen's Park Observer, Budget Day today in Ontario. Sabrina, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thanks for having me.
What is going on at Burlington City Hall? Two senior staffers are gone. Councillors ready to challenge strong mayor powers. And it looks as if there is a retention issue. Let's bring in Marianne Mead Ward, mayor of the city of Burlington, and here now. Marianne, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm very well. Thank you. Thanks for the time to talk.
So what's going on, Marianne? We're hearing issues in regard to retention at City Hall. But what does that have to do with strong mayor powers?
You know, City Hall experiences normal turnover like every municipal organization, large organization. So the motion around the strong mayors came forward from councillors, and according to their motion, the rationale was they only recently became aware that some, not all, of these powers could be delegated, and so they asked me to consider that.
So are you or have you been using strong mayor powers in this process?
Yeah, so it's really important for us to have a fact-based and thoughtful conversation around strong mayors. So let me start by saying I think the angst that was started right from the beginning of strong mayors was really around that one piece that you could introduce a bylaw and have it passed with one-third support. That is anti-democratic. It should be struck from the legislation. It's still there. But there were a whole bunch of other things as well. And we haven't really had a thoughtful, fact-based conversation about some of those. So we had a bit of an opportunity to do that today at council. So have I had to issue a mayor's decision? That's the technical term. Absolutely. There have been 17 of them. There's a requirement under the legislation to post those online. So there's complete transparency and accountability. And fully 11 of those were simply to sign a decision saying accept the council decisions of the most recent council meeting. So I have to sign a piece of paper now to action the decisions of council. So there's 11 of those. Mayors now are required under the legislation to introduce a budget. Two of the decisions related to that, our budget was democratically approved by the majority of council. That hasn't changed. So I really do encourage people to read that. Every municipality is required to have a register of strong mayor powers. Please read them. Find out what's happening in your community and why. And so, yeah, the community will continue to see those decisions really because they're required. For council business to continue, I have to sign a piece of paper to say they can continue.
With all due respect, the reason we have you on, Marianne, is to explain all that, not to send us to a website to read up on this. So I remember you saying before that you weren't into any of the strong mayor powers or what have you, and that you would be against that. And now you're saying that you have used those. And again, if this is all just technicality, why is council so concerned?
Well, I think it would be good to let council speak for themselves on this matter. And what I can tell you is that we've lived with this now for 8 months. We've had a better, experience of what it actually means versus what some of the rumors and misinformation and fears out there about these. They're really a set of new responsibilities and duties for the mayor. So certainly there are concerns. I've heard those concerns from council and the community. I will think about those in terms of what can be delegated back to council or staff. There's four or five of them out of the suite that can be. And the balance are duties. You have no choice in respect of, for example, the budget. You have to present a budget and direct staff to present a budget, and you have to do it. Otherwise, you have no budget. So, you know, I think that's the kind of discussion that is really important to level set what is truly happening here. You know, when I think about the decisions and the duties that have been really downloaded to mayors, a lot of mayors have kept all of those responsibilities. Some have offloaded some of those responsibilities. Some have offloaded all the responsibilities to councillor staff, but almost all of them have done so with some additional guidance. So, for example, they've said, I'm turning over structure of the city, but I want it in consultation with mayor and council. So I've asked council, you know, give me till the next council meeting to have a look at all of the additional responsibilities that have been given to mayors and to myself now under this legislation. And let me think about how we might move forward in a collaborative way and what guidance might be helpful. So I'll be reporting back to council in April on that.
Do you think there's more transparency needed on your part, Marianne, simply because, you know, you talk about the fear and misinformation. This is all within City Hall. I mean, this is not coming from the street. This is coming from your own council. Is there more transparency needed here?
Well, we had our discussion publicly in full view of the obviously residents, yourself. We're talking about it now. It is a fully transparent conversation that we're having. And the issue didn't come up before. We've been living in this new context for 8 months. I would say we've been a very collaborative council for 5 years and for sure for the last 8 months. And, you know, here we are. So we're having the conversation and we're having it in public exactly as we should.
Are you a supporter of strong mayor powers then?
I am going to look at the powers that have been, they're actually duties, they're responsibilities and duties that have been given. Some can be delegated, most cannot. And I am committed to fulfilling my responsibilities to the public. Ultimately, that's my major accountability, is what do residents expect me to do in service to them? I now have new responsibilities, didn't ask for them, didn't want them, but they are there. I can't give them back. And so,
you don't have to use them, do you? I mean, that's what the council is asking for.
Well, I just tried to explain earlier that in order for a budget to come forward, and I think we would all agree it's extremely important for a budget to be passed every year, yeah. I have to issue a staff direction, which is called a mayor's decision, which is technically using the duties assigned to me. So I think it's so important for us to actually have a thoughtful, fact-based conversation about what this means and what this doesn't, what you are able all right. to or required to do and what you are not. And that's where the fear mongering has come
well,
in.
Well, we got to run, Marianne, because we're right out of time. Right. But it certainly sounds like council and the public is ready for that discussion.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
As we announced earlier on, trespass notices delivered to those in the encampment outside of City Hall. To talk more about all of this, Larry Deani with us, former mayor of City of Hamilton, here now. Larry, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am well, Scott. Pleased to be on.
Boy, this is a tough situation because, you know, and I keep hammering away that too many people chasing too few services, and then that's complicated with the population increases that we're seeing. But there's really, what do you do with this situation at this point? I mean, the best way to deal with this is not to end up here in the first place. Now we're here. How do you deal with this? I mean, is there not some sort of major, I don't know, whether it's a tent city, a small home city, whether it's the medical tents we saw during the pandemic? Doesn't something need to be done here, Larry, other than just moving these people around?
Well, yeah, you know, it is a complicated situation. There's no question about that. But let's see if we can sort of take it step by step in terms of what's happening, both big picture and what's happening here in the city of Hamilton. We're not unique. These tent cities, these encampments, are in communities right across the country. I would say probably beyond our country, even certainly outside of Hamilton, for sure. And the reason are complex, and you know, they're being paid attention to, whether it's lip service or whether people are really putting you know, money behind the problems. You know, whether you go to the federal government or the provincial government or certainly municipal governments, they all want to address the housing issue, the homelessness issue, the unhoused population that we've got. So it is being paid attention to. However, there's also a political element to this. This encampment in front of City Hall, and I've driven by it almost on a daily basis, began in January. So, in February, right, towards the end of February, and here we are at the end of March. So it's been there for a month, and it's been growing. And I'm told that the majority of people there, someone who's an advocate actually that I bumped into at a coffee shop this morning, indicated to me that they're more protesters than encampers right now there. So there's a political message going out to governments. And if you drive by, you know, you'll see that there's Ford, the premier is being criticized. The city is being criticized. I didn't see any Trudeau, anti-Trudeau signs, but I'm sure they just forgot to include him in the criticism as well. So there's a political element to this as well. And what's the result of it? Is it getting more money for homeless and unhoused people? Not really. The city of Hamilton actually has increased its budget for homelessness by over 30% over this last year. Look at the budget documents. They're spending about $140 million a year on the homelessness issue, on the affordable housing issue, and they've increased the budget by 30%. And they're actually, in terms of percentage, outspending both of the other levels of government as well. And so when I stopped the other day in front of City Hall, waiting for the light to turn green so I could proceed, there was an individual with a big sign that said, "Where is the mayor?" I lowered my window and I said, and he came over to me thinking I was an advocate, and I asked him, "What would you like the mayor to do?" He really didn't have anything concrete to say other than, to shrug his shoulders at the fact that people don't have a roof over their heads. Mm-hmm. And so they're being told to go there and protest without really knowing what it is that they want out of the city more than the city is already doing. And so the city now has a protocol, and I reread it this afternoon in preparation for this talk, which essentially says, be kind, protect the dignity of these individuals. They can stay for a little while. The tents are numbered, but after that, we're going to move them out. And so now they have to move them out, because part of the equation here as well, and I've been hearing from these folks too, people who drive by are saying, what's happening to our city? Why is this being allowed to continue? Why does downtown Hamilton and the seat of government look like and they use very unkind words, I don't want to repeat them, but you can imagine what they might be. Mm-hmm. And so along with that, of course, is the danger to the residents themselves. I saw a couple of people, as I say, I was stopped waiting for the light to change, were stretched out. I don't know if they'd fainted, whether they were taking illegal drugs. I have no idea about that, but they looked as if they needed attention. And so we cannot allow this to perpetuate. There needs to be some concerted and coordinated effort to assist those people that are really in need, get the politicians out, and I don't mean the elected politicians, those who are using these folks to push for whatever program is high on their list, get them out of the equation, try to help these folks and follow up on the protocol that the city has passed, which essentially says, protect the dignity, try to get them a place to stay, help those who need help mentally or physically, but also make the city look as if it's organized and not the disorganized mess that is being presented to people as they drive by City Hall right now.
Larry, how does this change future discussion in government, whether it's provincial, municipal, federal, whatever? I mean, we've been really slow to react to these things, slow to build, slow to do everything. I mean, you know, we're talking about the washroom in the park that burnt down. It's going to take 4 years to do that, I think was the headline. And it's Canada. It's Canada. It takes 4 years to build everything, including an outhouse. How does this change future discussions? Because again, we know a lot of these are self-inflicted wounds because of slow government. What do we learn from this?
Well, let me tell you that you know, and this may be the silver lining here, that certainly people are talking about it, and whether it's individuals, you know, I go to a coffee clutch of retired educators Thursday mornings. I try to make it as much as possible. A nice cross-section of opinions. People are in the middle, they're politically on the right, they're on the left, but all of them want to see people helped. They all want to see people who have legitimate needs helped. And so they're looking for governments to assist. But by the same token, they don't want to be taken advantage of either. And they see that there's an agenda here on the part of some of the advocates that wants to put all the resources in one direction to the detriment, perhaps, of other needs that municipalities have as well. So there is a conversation going on. Respectfully, and I say this to my former colleagues and comrades who are elected right now, the mistake that Hamilton has made, in my estimation, is that they're trying to solve the problem all on their own backs and the backs of the local taxpayers only, when it needs to be an all hands on deck. I mentioned, and I got these figures right from the city website, that the city is contributing more in terms of dollars, percentage wise, than other levels of government, and we are the poorest of the three that can afford to spend all of our money in this direction. We need the assistance of the other levels as well. So it needs to be a coordinated effort. And if people go to the Hamilton website, and it's up again, thankfully, and get some of the updates on encampments and what the city has been doing, it's pretty impressive. Has it solved the problem? No, because the problem is so big. And people are keeping it also front and center because of some political agenda that they may have. But the city is doing, you know, what it can and what it should. Other levels need to collaborate and cooperate. And then it's going to take some time as well. Bureaucracy and the speed of government doesn't necessarily help. Look at the debate we're having in Stony Creek, where the councillor who wants to be part of the solution, but is also listening to people that don't want, and businesses, and the medical community that has a major presence near those parking lots downtown. He's offered up some other spaces that would offer
Larry, to talk. We're out of time, Larry. We got to stop it there. We'll continue with the discussion over the parking in Stony Creek, though, for sure. Larry Deani with us, former mayor, City of Hamilton. The Bank of Canada is warning that weak productivity and low business investment has become a national emergency, making it harder to control inflation and risking the erosion of the standard of living. Simply put, we're not building anything anymore. We're not creating anything. We're not selling anything. Let's bring in Dr. Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University, with us now. Ian, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing very well. Thank you, Scott.
I bet you're not surprised by this, Ian.
I'm not only not surprised. I mean, in one sense, I am surprised. I mean, I knew that this is what they think. What shocked me, or that's a bit too strong, but really hit me, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, is this is one of the most extraordinary speeches I've read by the Bank of Canada. And I've been reading Bank of Canada speeches since the 70s when I worked in banking. And, you know, many Bank of Canada speeches in the, quote, good old days were boring and filled with platitudes and not very illuminating, except that period in the very, very late 70s when the speeches were really shocking. That's when they were saying, look, we're in crisis. We're in an emergency. Inflation's out of control. We've got to do something really radical. And that's when they ran the rates up to 20. I haven't really seen anything like that since, until I read this speech. Central bankers are not known for radical speeches. Let's be very clear. They're normally gray, boring, you know, people that, you know, use words that nobody understands and their eyes glaze over. This speech is really something. She said, she has this great metaphor in there. She says, you know, you go in any building and it says, you see on the wall by the elevator or by the front door, it says, in an emergency, break the glass. She said, it's time in Canada to break the glass. She's saying this isn't a crisis. We've always talked about productivity as a crisis. She's saying we're now facing an emergency. This is unbelievable language for central bankers, I assure you. It's just astonishing. And I would also, my second point, Scott, is I really do think, and this is meant in a completely nonpartisan way, I'm not a partisan, I don't donate to any party, I'm not involved in any political party, but I think that this represents a rupture or a break between the Bank of Canada and the government of Canada. And I'm referring to the finance minister and the prime minister. There's very clearly, and it's again, this isn't about partisanship. They very clearly are condemning and criticizing the overarching policy approach of this government, which involves, you know, protecting industries, designating winners and losers. There, I mean, she just went right at it with two by fours or sledgehammers, going after the fact that we have all these protected industries and they've been protected by government. You know, telecom, banking, supply chain. You and I, Scott, have been talking about these things. And okay, I'm just a professor in a business school. This is the governor, well, the deputy governor of the Bank of Canada. And anyone who thinks that this is a deputy governor who's gone rogue, those who know the Bank of Canada study it. Every speech is prepared by a team in the Bank of Canada. And every speech, it's my understanding, is signed off by the governor of the Bank of Canada, the deputy governing count, the governing council, which is the governor and the five deputy governors, work together as a team. They speak as one. This is the voice of the Bank of Canada speaking. This is not a particular governor, deputy governor who just has some, you know, some griping that she wants to get, you know, unload. This is the policy view of the central bank. And they are very clearly in their central bank way, and then using the language that they use, they're saying that the government of Canada, the policy direction of the government of Canada is they're going down the wrong road. And that's why I found this speech so extraordinary.
Is the prime minister listening to this? Does this resonate with government as they're looking to resonate with Canadians? I mean, clearly we're all feeling it. And now, as you said, it's come from a pretty credible source. How does this resonate in government?
It's interesting you asked that question, because I was just talking to a friend of mine who's in Ottawa. I mean, most of the people I know are in Ottawa, of course. We were discussing this broader issue. And I put forward the view, and I want to repeat it to you, that I think now for the next, until the election, which is sometime next year, we believe, okay, in 2025, that really, I think we're almost in a logjam. I mean by that, the government, Mr. Trudeau, and the government has decided to double down on the policy direction they're going in. And we know what that direction is, so I'm not going to repeat it. And they're betting the farm that they're going to pull it off and that they're going to turn around public opinion. I'm not here to speculate on whether they will or will not. They might not. The polls say no, but polls can change. Where I'm going with this is to answer your question. I think that we're going to not see any major policy changes of any kind before the next election. If the Poilievre is elected, then you're going to see some very, very major changes across, I believe, in you know, Canada Post, deficits, trade relationship with the United States, the whole nine yards. However, if the Liberals are reelected, anyone who thinks it's going to be business as usual, just the same old, I think are in for a rude shock, because the numbers are all going south. I'm talking our productivity numbers, our foreign exchange, our the exchange rate. I'm talking the productivity. I'm talking GDP. And so because they're getting worse and worse, if the Liberals are reelected, they're going to be faced with the same set of bad numbers and bad economy that the Conservatives will face if they're elected. So that there's going to be change coming, Scott, I believe. And I mean big change, major change. But it won't be until after the election, because Mr. Trudeau has bet the farm that he's not going to. He thinks he can pull it off. He thinks he has enough time. He may be right. I don't know. But he has enough time for the economy to recover, interest rates to come down, inflation to come down, and convince enough people to be reelected. And some people may be tearing out their hair and their hair may be on fire. But what I'm suggesting is, even if that scenario happens, that the underlying economic fundamentals that the Bank of Canada is talking about are not going to go away. They're very, very real. And that the government, who whatever government is elected after the next election, is going to have a first-class mess on their hands, and they're going to have to act differently. That's my point.
Productivity down. All with the Greek prime minister is here trying to buy Canadian liquid natural gas, as other leaders have tried to do. How does this bode, considering we're in a situation where we need these deals, yet we're turning them away?
That's the kind of change I'm talking about. I understand that Mr. Trudeau was elected in the last election. I'm not trivializing that. He had a mandate, and he believes he's following that mandate. But, you know, you can follow a mandate, but at the same time, as you know, I talk all the time about evidence-based data, because I really live in that to me is the reality of the world. And I'm talking the economic fundamentals. That's another word for, you know, the evidence-based reality. And the economic fundamentals are going very badly in the wrong direction. CD Howe is documenting this. Business capital investment, which is the factories of tomorrow, is going down, down, down. Productivity is going down, down, down. And we're turning away things that could contribute to that. You know, liquefied natural gas to help the Germans deal with Putin, or to China to get its, because it is the number one emitter in the world. And we're not doing that. We were deliberately saying, no, we're not, you know, no mining, no pipelines, no exports of liquefied natural gas. What I'm suggesting is that after the election, I think all of that is going to be all of those decisions. Many of the major policy decisions of the last 9 years are going to be on the table for reform and change and transformation, because we're realizing it's taking us down the wrong road. This isn't because of some little green men from Mars came down and said, we don't like you, Canada, anymore, and so we're going to change your fundamentals. The economic fundamentals are going in the wrong direction because we are making decisions that are causing the fundamentals to go in the wrong direction.
Dr. Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University, Bank of Canada, warning that weak productivity and low business investment in the country has become a national emergency. Ian, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the tax-paying customer, to have the last word. This one from Mr. Lowe. There was a time in this great nation when we produced state-of-the-art fighter jets, clothes, tires, household things, a whole bunch of consumer goods. Now we buy offshore and we'll not even sell our abundant fuel resources to nations in need. We need a regime change. Mr. Lowe, keep right, accept to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.